It is now 8:15. I usually like to start on time because I was born in England, where we always hope the trains run on time. I know that in Sri Lanka, I'm not sure if it's true in this country, but all the Sri Lankan disciples over in Australia, they always say Sri Lankan time, which means, no, maybe half an hour later, an hour later. Is that true? So anyway, for today's Dhamma talk, I've already got up to stage 8 in the Anapanasati, just the calm and delightful breath, and just mentioned what happened next. When the breath vanishes, we get the nimittas, the lights in the mind. So this talk is devoted to nimittas. And I enjoy giving such talks because I really get off on them. I delight in them. So, what happens is that when the breath vanishes, sometimes people just go into dullness, darkness, they can't find the breath, they get worried. And even some meditators who haven't heard about meditation much before, when their body disappears and they can't find the breath, they go, ah, I'm going to die, I'm not breathing. And they get a lot of fear, only because they have not been told what's happening and not being reassured that it's totally safe. Now, I'm a well-known meditation teacher. I've been teaching meditation even before I was a monk. And never once, not even on one occasion, have I had any casualties. I have a perfect track record. No one has gone crazy. No one has died. So everyone is perfectly safe, whatever happens in this meditation. So, when breath disappears, you don't die. You just bliss out and have a wonderful time. So what usually happens is when people have more confidence in what's happening, a bit more faith and trust, then they allow even the darkness to stay for a while before the lights come up. And it's just natural. It's just what happens. But even better for those who practice with the breathing until it really does become delightful, and you have so much piti sukha with the breathing, that once the breathing vanishes, you don't even have any dull state or dark state. You shouldn't call it a dull state, but a blackness. Instead, you just have a beautiful light comes up pretty quickly, simply because the difference between those two states, when the breath vanishes in the first state, the mindfulness is not quite enough yet, and you know that because there's not enough delight and happiness. In the second state, the mindfulness is strong, and it's accompanied by delight, by piti sukha, which means you're bright enough to be able to see that light, aware enough to be able to see more subtle images. Now, that light does appear in many different forms, many different types of nimittas. And just from my experience of being a teacher and talking to people about their nimittas and comparing them to my own ones, usually the first type of nimitta which comes up can sometimes be like a screen. Just like watching just a, not any particular image, but a whole screen of light. Not very bright yet, but that's what you are watching, just a screen of light. And if that is the case, it does count as a nimitta. It's only just one of the early nimittas, which is not really refined yet. And first of all, to mention, the color is not important of these nimittas. Because you can have all different types of colors, even in the same meditation, and it is not important at all. One of the weirdest colors which one of my students had was he came to me and said that his nimitta was black, jet black. And straight away I thought, no, black, that must be something bad or terrible you've done, because that is just the way that we have black and white in our cultures. even just as a side issue for you, in marriages. And I think you do sometimes Western-type marriages in Sri Lanka. In a marriage, the woman always wears white, and the man always wears a dark suit. And the reason why the woman wears white is a symbol of her purity. And the reason why the man wears black is a symbol of you-know-what. And anyway, this man had this very dark black nimitta, and I doubted him at first. I've never heard of this before. And then he started to tell me some more details about it. The most beautiful black he'd ever seen. Deeper than coal. Deeper than velvet. It shimmered in its blackness. And when he started to say things like that, I said, okay, that's a nimitta. I've never had a black nimitta before, but it didn't really matter. And for your information, maybe because he had that black nimitta, the reason was his profession was a pest exterminator. He would go around spraying houses to get rid of cockroaches and ants and stuff. But he was otherwise a really good, kind man. And obviously, he could get into breaking that first precept as a profession. He could still get into a nimitta stage. Well done. But it's full of also happiness and bliss. So the colours are not important. However, as the nimitta does develop, the colours which you start to perceive as more black, more blue than blue, gold colours, which are a type of deep, incredibly brilliant gold, like you never see in this world. That is why the best way to describe them is more gold than gold, more yellow than yellow. And obviously when you see these things, you know exactly what I'm talking about. It's not the sort of, say, yellow or white you see in this world. It's far, far more pure, intense. And that is a common feature of these nimittas. And one of the reasons why is because you're not seeing it with your eyes. This is not a visual image. The sense of sight is usually gone by now. This is seeing it with your mind, with the sixth sense. It's a mental image. And I often wondered why it was that you see these nimittas as lights, rather than as smells or any of these other objects of the five senses. And, you know, just investigating, having many, many nimittas for long periods of time, I started to realize that as a human being, our sense of sight is perhaps the most dominant of our sense bases. We spend more time looking and understanding this world through sight than we do through certainly smell and taste, and even hearing and physical touch. We see the world more than anything else, more than touch the world. A good example of that is when you go to the airport, they scan your face, they look at it. That's how they tell who you are. They don't smell you. Oh yes, that's Ajahn Brahmawangsa, because the smell is recorded in the computer. Although a dog probably could recognize you by the smell. or they can actually voice recognition. Sometimes you can tell a person by their voice. But the sight is the most dominant of our senses. And it's because of that, that when the mind tries to understand these mental phenomena, the way that perception, sanya, works, is that it tries to find something similar in its data bank of past experience to compare it with. So this nimitta which you see or which you experience is compared just most usually with a light, because our database of visual experiences is greater than anything else. And that's how we perceive it. What is it similar to? And so your perception throws up the experience that it's a light in the mind. But of course, it is only just a mental object. And it's important to understand this, because sometimes that nimitta becomes very, very, very bright and really intense. And it's happened to me, and it's happened to many other people who get nimittas, that sometimes the thought comes up in your mind that you cannot stand such brilliance. The light is too intense. You're going to go blind. And that illogical fear, irrational fear, just makes you stop the meditation. You open your eyes. But of course, you're not seeing it with your eyes. That light can appear brighter than 1,000 suns. And you don't go blind at all, because you're not seeing it with your eyes. But this is just how it usually is experienced. Now, when that first nimitta comes, whether it's a bright nimitta or whether it's a screen nimitta, quite often that people forget the part of meditation. Everything they were doing before which made that nimitta arise, they put that aside and they try and control it, or they get afraid of it, they try and do something with it. At which point the nimitta disappears. If you do anything, you are disturbing the stillness and the nimitta vanishes. And the best simile to explain what I mean, again, came from my master Ajahn Chah. And he gave the simile of the still forest pool. I have never been able to find or come up with a better simile for how to deal with nimittas. And in those days, 50, 60 years ago, when people could go into the jungles of Thailand, and there were many, many wild animals, in these days, the jungles of Thailand have been replaced by big cities and towns. And there are more wild animals in those cities than there ever were in the forest, and they're called people. They're more dangerous. But in those days, you could go into the jungle and wander wherever you wish. And I must say that I was just at the end of that time. I remember going into some of the jungles, the rainforests, which had never been touched for I don't know how many centuries, in the far northeast of Thailand, and also on the border between Thailand and Burma. I remember one huge forest in the far northeast of Thailand, and you've been walking in the hot, dusty roads of Thailand, in the paddy fields, and suddenly you enter this forest, and it's so cool. And also I noticed it was always fragrant, so hopefully that's what the reserves in Sri Lanka are like. It was fragrant because there was always some flower in bloom. And you see the elephant droppings on the paths, and hear their sounds in the distance. Fortunately, not too close to you. But it was like a beautiful old forest. But unfortunately, because population pressures, that forest was burnt down while I was staying in it. And it was just a terrible thing to see, just the tragedy of a beautiful forest being destroyed in front of your eyes. But anyway, in those days you'd find many of those jungles and forests sweet and cool. And Ajahn Chah always taught us what to do if we went to those jungles. Always to, if there was no village around, at least find a lake or a river in the afternoon, maybe about 3 o'clock. Because walking as a monk who just walks from place to place, you get very sweaty and dirty, and you really need a wash to freshen your body up so the meditation can work. And also, many of your robes were smelly, so you give those a rinse out in the lake or in the river. And lastly, you had to fill your water bottle up using a strainer, so that you had enough water to drink, so you did not dehydrate. And so that was the tradition. But he said many, many times he would find those lakes in the jungles, in the forest, and he would sit, he would wash his clothes and fill his water bottle. And in the Thai tradition they had these umbrellas just like the golf umbrellas you see these days, quite big ones, on which they would drape a tubular mosquito net. And you would sit in there and sleep in there at night to keep the mosquitoes away, because malaria was very rife in Thailand. Still is there today in some places. So you'd use a mosquito net. But he always said, please put your umbrella mosquito net about 15 to 30 meters away from the edge of the lake or the river, because in the evening, the animals will come out to drink and also play by that forest pool. And he told many stories, many anecdotes, as monks do, of their times in the jungles, peaceful, beautiful times. And he said sometimes he would not close his eyes in the evening, especially if the moon was up and he could see what was happening, because he'd wait for the jungle animals to come out to play. And these days, apparently, there are TV channels called National Geographic and Nature Channel or whatever it's called, where people can watch the animals in the wild, not knowing they're being photographed, play and have fun. And it's a very popular and entertaining to watch, because those animals, they play around so much like human beings do. And one experience I had was not actually in a mosquito net. I spent one rage retreat, one was, in an abandoned temple up in the mountains in the north of Thailand. It was an idyllic place for an English monk, because it was right in the middle of a tea plantation. So as an English monk, it was like being in paradise. Beautiful place to meditate, and as much tea as you could drink. Oh, that was heaven. And on one occasion, I was in my hut, just a simple kuti made out of wood. And because it was made out of wood, just sawn by the local villagers, there was not holes in the wood. And on this occasion, the dry season, when everything was parched and even the animals were struggling to find enough to drink, I put out a little dipper of water for the birds in the afternoon. And I would watch them through the knot hole in the wood. And after a few days, the birds found that water. And the most strange thing, which I never ever expected to see, was that there were birds of so many different species. Big ones, small ones, so many different species. They found that water, and they organized themselves into a queue. A whole line of birds, one after the other, first come first in the front of the queue. The one who came last was in the back of the queue, waiting to have a drink, to wash, you know, splash around like birds do. And when the bird had finished, the next one would come in. Now, if this was birds in Singapore, I would think, okay, I can understand that. That's Singapore custom. But not even Thai lay people stand in the queue. They always rush to jump in first. But this was so weird. Birds of different species, all queued up. And just like any country, there's always a queue jumper. One bird would come in and try to get into that little pool of water first. At which point, all the other birds would jump out of the queue and jump on that bird and peck him and beat him up until he was chased away. And then afterwards, they'd all go back in line exactly where they were before. The birds of different species organizing themselves like that. I'd never seen such a thing in my life. But it happened every afternoon. It was well worth watching. So there's lots of joy watching animals in the wild and just seeing just what they do. And actually, just one other interesting experience. Because if you go into the jungles, I'm not sure what it's like in the jungles here in Sri Lanka. But then you see some very, very strange things. Because in that monastery, and I'm a monk, you can't exaggerate. You can't sort of not tell the truth. I was sitting in my cave, in my hut, meditating, but you know, you weren't in jhana, you felt that something was happening outside. You were sensitive enough to realize that something strange was up. Like people say, electricity in the air. You can feel that, you know, what's going on? Something is not right. And I went out of my hut and looked in the sky, and every inch of the sky was covered with birds. Millions of birds were up in the sky. Almost every bird which was in that forest jungle were up there flying in the air. And amidst them were two enormous birds. I'd never seen the like before. These were birds bigger than eagles. Once when I was in Norway, I was walking up in the mountains, just enjoying some solitude, came over a ridge and saw a king's eagle, it's called. It was just standing there, bigger than me, standing. I didn't know what it was like if it spread its wings. But you see, a bird like that, as tall as you, when it's standing, immediately you turn around and go back. I'm not going to mess with a bird like that. So, you know, seeing eagles close up, really, really big, and this was bigger than that. And what was strange was all the other birds were up in the air with them. It was almost like a great Mahanayaka, or the king was actually coming to Sri Lanka, and everybody had to come out to pay respects. And there's a pair of birds, and sometimes you really wonder these days, was that what Garudas are? Magical birds? Because I've never seen anything like that in my life. And you only see such things, you know, in the jungles. Don't know where they've gone to these days. Garudas, Nagas, are they real? Maybe they are. Maybe that's what I saw. Obviously, there's no cameras around. So it's a shame I could not actually take a snapshot and show people. But anyway, great experiences living far away from the cities and the towns and even the villages. And some of the things you see are so close to what you see or what you read in the suttas. Anyway, so that's Garuda experience. Anyway, back to the nimittas. His Ajahn Chah would actually sit there some evenings with his eyes wide open and watch the animals come out to drink and play. Only, he said, he had to be perfectly still. He couldn't move his body. He couldn't say anything. Because if he did, those animals would sense a human being was there. And in those days, as these days too, you may be afraid of a tiger, but a tiger is more afraid of you. More tigers have been killed by human beings than human beings by tigers. But any human being in the jungle, in the forest, most wild animals would think they were hunters or trappers. And so they'd be terrified of human beings. Even though you are a monk and will never harm anything, the animals don't usually know that. So they just assume this is very dangerous. If you saw a tiger, what would you do? Imagine a tiger seeing you. So, he had to be perfectly still. And the animals came out. Their eyesight was not that good, but they would smell. And they could smell a human being if you moved. So he had to be totally still, not say anything. And when they smelled and saw if anyone was there, because he was still, he vanished. He was invisible to them. So they'd come out with their young to play, to wash, and like any young animal, always playing around, messing around. Over in our monastery in Perth, we always have every year the young kangaroos coming out to play. And I've been living there for over 30 years now. And I always enjoy the antics of these young, they call them joeys, the young kangaroos. And you saw them jumping up and down with so much energy. And they went around to another kangaroo, not the mother, and the other kangaroo with their hand whacked them around the face. Don't you ever do that again. Just teaching the kangaroo that, you know, there are boundaries, so don't play around too much. So, it's wonderful just watching the antics of animals. So in this particular case, Ajahn Chah would enjoy watching the tigers and their cubs, the elephants, and all these other animals come out to play, only if he was still. And he would continue. After the ordinary animals came out to play, then sometimes these very rare and incredibly beautiful animals would come out. They were so sensitive that he had to be perfectly still before they would emerge from the jungles. If he moved even a slightest bit and said, "Wow," the animal would know that, go back into the forest and never come out again for days. But if he was perfectly still, didn't move, didn't even think, that animal would not know he was there and come out to play by the still forest pool. Beautiful animals. Animals the like of which he never knew existed. Even most of his parents and teachers never knew they existed. Incredibly wonderful, but very, very shy. And that was his simile for the jhanas and even the big nimittas. They only come out to play in your still mind when it's perfectly still. When nimitta comes and you say, "Wow, a nimitta, yes, got it." It runs away and it never comes out again for days. If you try and take notes or take a photograph, it runs away. You have to be like you're not there. So still, not thinking, not commenting, not taking notes in your mind, not moving. And then the nimittas come out and stay with you. To me, that was one of the most amazing similes by which I could understand how to develop those nimittas. So sometimes the nimittas, very common, the nimittas will come up and they're, I don't know why this is common, it hasn't really happened to me, I just usually get the nimittas straight up. Sometimes the nimittas come in a corner of your mind. As if, this is only a simile, as if they're checking you out, are you still enough for me to come to you? And if a nimitta is not in the center, it's in some corner, and if you go looking for it, it disappears. You just have to be patient, and a nimitta light will come and center itself, when you're still enough. Sometimes, I mentioned earlier, mindfulness gives you feedback. So from the mindfulness of the body, you can actually learn how to relax the body. The nimitta gives you feedback how still you are and how still you have to be. It's a dial. It's like a very refined piezometer. You might call it a stillometer. Shows you how still you are. Because if you're not still, the nimitta goes. If you are still, it stays and brightens up. And also, if you are, the nimitta comes and it just goes all over the place, again, it obviously means that you're not still. So when nimittas first come up, I say that sometimes it's like a screen nimitta which comes up, just now a sheet of white or something. If that is the case, again, the best thing to do is to be still. And usually somewhere within usually the center of that screen, just a beautiful light, like a moon or a sun comes up. Comes from actually within. Remember, even with nimittas, the next stage is not to the left or to the right of where you are, it's right in the middle of what you're seeing. You always go in, like the simile I gave the first day of the lotus. Opening up, always going in. That's where the nimittas are. So the next nimitta, the really big ones, are right in the center. So if it's a screen nimitta, just, leave it alone, don't do anything, be still. And then you'll experience, when you're ready, that a beautiful nimitta will come out from the center of that. Sometimes, though, that people have what I first called firework nimittas. Flashes in the sky, a spot here, a spot there, all over the place, bang. Really good fun, but really not good enough. Your mind is not still enough yet. So it just flashes up, you react, and it just disappears again. One of the reasons why we react and we aren't still enough is because people either get afraid or they get excited. In the Upakalesa Sutta, where the Buddha describes the obstacles of the nimittas, those are the two main obstacles. There's always other obstacles, but those are the two greatest kalesas, in my experience, obstacles, hindrances to developing the nimittas. And the fear one. To overcome the fear of these powerful nimittas, first of all, have a bit of sadha, trust, faith. First of all, in my teachings, I'm a good monk, I've been around a long time, I've got a good track record, you can check me out, I don't deceive you. So, now I say it's perfectly safe, try it out. If you don't believe me, check the Buddha's teachings, you can't go past those. And the Buddhas in the Upaklesa Sutra said this is what's supposed to happen, this is developing it. This is the ninth stage of Anapanasati, experiencing the jitta, because after a while you realize that's what you're watching. That's how the mind, so that's how you experience the jitta, the mind, through the nearest sense, which is sight. That's how you experience it. And if you don't believe me there again, you will find in the suttas the Buddha saying such things that this jitta is pabhasara. It's radiance, the radiant jitta, when the five hindrances have been subdued. And that's in the suttas. And what can that mean? Radiant mind, if you've had nimittas, say, well, that must be what it means, because that's what happens when the five hindrances are subdued. Your mind is incredibly beautiful. It's radiant. That's what it feels like. That's what it appears like. Beautiful, radiant light. So don't be afraid. This is what's supposed to happen. One of the other ways to overcome fear is understanding that most experience, most new experiences, you go through three stages, which I call recognition, familiarity, and ease. Even when you come to this place for the first time, in your bed, you probably don't sleep well the first night. The second night, sleep a bit better. After three or four nights, you sleep really well. I have the experience commonly because I travel around so much, sometimes staying in a different bed every night for a fortnight, traveling around giving talks all over the place. And sometimes you notice the first night you don't sleep so well because you're psychologically, your body, your mind is not used to that environment. But after a while, you recognize it. And from recognition, oh, it's safe, it's okay, I'm used to this. From recognition, you get familiarity. And from familiarity, you go into that third stage of ease. It's just like your own bed in your own kuti, in your own temple. So you can relax in it. That's stages of recognition, familiarity, and ease can be applied to all levels of meditation. Even for some people, when I ask them to watch the breathing, they say, what do you mean? What should I watch? And at first, they don't know what they're supposed to do. But after a while, they can recognize, oh yeah, the breath. But when they first recognize the breath, they always tend to control it. You know, it's rough because they're interfering with it. After a while, they become familiar with it, and they're at ease with it, then they can actually let it go. They realize they don't need to control, because control always comes as a result of fear. So it's the same with even especially the nimittas. At first, when they come up, because you're not familiar with them, you don't recognize them, what it actually is, you tend to control them, and they tend to disappear. It's fear. But after a while, oh, it's just only the nimitta again. Ah, oh, it's just a beautiful nimitta. And then, with that attitude, the nimitta can come. You can leave it alone, because you're at ease with it. You know, sometimes I don't know why. Sometimes people are scared of me. They come to their interviews, you can see they're all so tense. And people have known me for a long time. You know, stayed with me, know that I'm not a dangerous monk. I'm not going to hit you or even scold you. I just don't do that. I realize it's not going to be helpful. But nevertheless, people are still afraid. But after a while, you recognize me, and you become familiar with me, and sometimes some of you become so over-familiar, there's no respect at all. Well, I don't mind that, because we're friendship, which is wonderful. And so you're totally at ease, like just meeting an old friend. Now, those are the stages, even with nimittas. After a while, it becomes like an old friend. You're totally at ease with a nimitta when it comes up. That means you overcome part of the fear. The other part of the fear comes from understanding that this is powerful. You're going into some very, very strong meditation states now. And you know that this is going to lead, you know, really to some very profound insights. And some of you don't realize you're not ready for those insights. You don't really want to become enlightened. It's a bit too much for me. This is big stuff. Are you ready to handle this? And also, strange, but it's true. People think, oh, enlightenment's a good idea. But if I handed enlightenment to you, here you are, do you want to take it? I said, no, I don't. I'm not ready yet. What it means, similar, very common simile I use often, the simile of a prisoner who's been in jail for 40 years. And now you're going to be released the following day. The doors of the prison are open for you. You can walk out. Many prisoners don't want to walk out. They're afraid of freedom. They've got used to being in jail. And the idea of freedom is just too frightening. That's why sometimes you get fear, even in nimitta stage. You're getting close to enlightenment, to jhanas. Are you ready to walk out of prison and be free? Some of you aren't. That's why you get afraid. So that's a bit more sadar in the Lord Buddha's teachings. And a bit more understanding that this prison you're living in, the prison of the five senses, is dukkha, through and through. But there's also the fear that to go further, you have to let go of control, which is the other thing which people are afraid of. Using a simile, it is like you are the driver of a car and I'm sitting in the passenger seat and we're going down these steep, windy roads, you know, down from Bandrawala down to the flatlands of Ratnapura. It's a very dangerous, windy road. And so you're driving down there, trying to watch the traffic, trying to be safe, and I tell you, in the passenger seat, I tell you, take your hand off the steering wheel and feet off the pedals. Don't control the car. Would you do that? Hopefully you wouldn't, otherwise I would die. But that's a simile in meditation. In meditation you do take your hands off the steering wheel. You do take your feet off the pedals. You do stop controlling. And the fear is, if I don't control, I'm going to crash. I'm going to injure myself. Because control is how we protect ourselves, or think we're protecting ourselves. But actually, in meditation, it's the controlling which is stopping you getting into the deep jhanas, or in the deep nimittas and the jhanas. And it's very scary to let go, especially at that stage. Up to jhanas, maybe you can let go, but at the nimitta stage even, can you let go enough to allow those nimittas just to develop by themselves? Much of what you're most attached to, your sense of self, your being, your controlling, has to be abandoned. And that is very, very scary. But don't be too embarrassed if you have fear come up in the meditation at this stage, because even the Buddha said his fear came up. So it's always just the fear of letting go of what you're attached to, your deepest attachment, your sense of control and your sense of being. You are disappearing. But many of you are committed to monastic life. And you're committed because you want to go. Not just be a teacher and not be a temple person who does rituals. You really want to go all the way to enlightenment. And it's open there for you. You have to be able to take your hand off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals at this particular stage. And even though it feels scary, to go for it. And if you don't let go, that nimitta will come up and it will just disappear again. It will flash. It will move all over the place. It will swirl. You get these incredible nimittas which go all over the place, which are fun to watch, but not really helpful. They're complicated nimittas and they are very mobile nimittas. They don't stand still and they're not simple. So, the job after you've got a nimitta, some sort of light in the mind, is number one, sampasadanang chitang, which means that to bring joy and brightness to that nimitta. I sometimes try to use an English word to polish it up, so it's more and more brilliant and bright and full of light and full of energy and full of bliss. And also samadhang chitang, which means to keep it stable. Stop it moving around. The first thing to do, this is stage 10 of the Anapanasati Sutta, the Sampasadanang Chitang, brightening up the nimitta. If you have a sheet nimitta, as I mentioned yesterday, a sort of a rag nimitta which is a bit dirty, there's always a beautiful bright part to it. If you have what I call a complicated nimitta, so you have see whole scenes. Like once I remember having a complicated nimitta of rolling green hills and nice streams and beautiful trees in the sunshine. It was a complicated nimitta. But I've obviously been doing this more than one life because I knew intuitively what to do. I look for the most beautiful part in that scenery. And it happened to be a dewdrop on a leaf, on one of the thousands of leaf, on one of those hundreds of trees which were in my vision. Something sparkled, like a dewdrop does in the sunshine. And that's all I needed. That little sparkle, my mind knew how to go straight towards that sparkle. It wasn't decided, it was pre-verbal, it just training, that's just what the mind did. Went to that little sparkle, and when you zoom in on that sparkle became this incredible, beautiful, bright, simple nimitta. That's how it works. So, if you see complicated nimittas, look for something which is twinkling or sparkling, which is beautiful. And just allow your mind to focus in on that, to zoom in on it. And what was a complicated image just becomes a sparkle, like a star, a beautiful thing, just one thing, there in your mind's eye. And that becomes the powerful nimittas. And to stay with those nimittas, to stabilize them, so they don't go all over the place, they don't go flashing around all over the place, moving here, moving there. I was once having trouble, this is my simile, trouble with my nimitta moving all over the place. And I couldn't settle it down. Couldn't like just bring it to a halt. And what happened? A simple experience. I was shaving. I had a, because being Westerners, we have to shave a lot. And had a mirror to make sure I wasn't cutting myself. And as I was shaving, I noticed the image of me in the mirror was moving to the left and right. And I realized it wasn't the mirror's fault. The image was moving because I, the one who was watching, was moving. And that simple experience just was the light bulb moment, the eureka moment for me to know how to stabilize my nimittas. The nimitta in my mind was moving all over the place because I was moving all over the place, the one which was watching. I'm not talking about a soul or the one who knows or anything. This is just a metaphor. The thing which was watching was moving all over the place. So what I was watching was moving. Because that nimitta you see you experience in your mind's eye in this stage is a reflection of your citta. It's just like the citta seeing itself in a mirror. That's a very accurate way of understanding what's happening. And if you're moving, the citta moves. So this is what I mean by feedback. That nimitta was giving me feedback on how still my mind was. If my mind was still active, that nimitta was active. If my mind slowed down and didn't do anything at all, then the nimitta started to slow down. Little by little, because the one who was watching was still, the nimitta became still, until it just stayed and didn't move at all. If I did anything, thought anything, decided to do anything, that nimitta will start moving again. That's what I mean by feedback. It gave me instructions how to be even more still. And I sometimes explain the whole path of meditation just like going to a school or a university. You get more and more exams, more tough each time, more difficult each time, just to see just how skilled you are. And at every test, you have to increase your skills. In every stage of this meditation, you have to increase your ability to be aware, mindful, and to be still. The deeper you go, the more skilled you have to be in being aware and being still. So to get to this stage, you have to be incredibly still, almost not moving. Now, I need to also say that at the time you have the first nimittas, yes, you can still hear some things and feel the body. This is not jhana yet. But as the nimittas progress and get deeper and more powerful, the less likely it is that you can hear things or feel the body. As the nimitta progresses, you get further and further distant from the five senses. And to understand what I mean, I give a little visual example. And I don't know how I'm going to do this because I have to use both hands. Can you hear me? Okay. How's that? Okay. This hand represents the level of the five senses. This hand represents the power of the mind. In most cases, most times of the day, your five senses are so strong and dominant, that's all that you experience. And the mind is so weak, you can't see that or feel that, experience that at all. In meditation, you suppress the five senses. You let them go, make them weaker and weaker and weaker, and you give more energy to the mind, so it gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And of course, you eventually reach a stage that the strength of the mind and the strength of the five senses are about equal. That's when nimittas start to arise. The nimitta strength of your mind, the strength of the five senses are roughly equal. So sometimes at this stage you can see the nimitta, but you can also hear sounds. And as the nimitta gets stronger and stronger, and the five senses get weaker and weaker, the nimitta starts to dominate. You can see the nimitta, that is really central, but you can hear sound, but it's like distant sounds. The body, you can hardly feel it. It is there, but distant, like it's 1,000 miles away. Until eventually the nimitta gets so strong, so dominant, that you can't hear sounds or feel the body anymore. Powerful, beautiful nimittas. And with that mindfulness, that power of the mind, there is always an increase in the bliss, in the happiness. That is the best sign that the mindfulness is strong, the nimittas are getting powerful. You are blissing out. And nimitta stage, that is where I had this experience years ago, and just recently somebody came with the same experience. I don't think they were copycatting me. They said they're experiencing with a nimitta stage so much bliss that they thought that no human being can take that bliss. They're going to explode in mental pleasure. And I remember that experience myself. Sometimes this is the indication of the power of that piti sukha. It's not weak stuff. It's huge. Huge to the point that you have that thought come up. And there's still thoughts at this stage, but they're very weak, usually just about the nimitta, nothing to do with past or future or family or anything else, just about the nimitta. You say, wow, this is just too much for me. I can't take any more pleasure. And you will understand that you can take more. You don't die. Nobody explodes because of pleasure. And it's not dangerous. You're not going to get attached to it. It's just going to take you into the jhanas. Actually, I must be honest with you, you can get attached to the pleasures of meditation. And if you do get really attached, I mean really attached to the pleasures of meditation, it means that you cannot go from anagami to arahat. You get stuck at the anagami level. And I think many of you will be satisfied with that. Only a non-returner. That's not bad for your monastic life. Will you settle for that? Yeah. Well, that's, you know, that last little attachment is just so easy to get rid of, the attachment to the jhanas. But anyway, at this particular stage, the nibbana becomes incredibly powerful. Very blissful. And sometimes people do get scared. Or the other one, of course, is because of the sheer power of it. You know, sometimes you see like a ghost or you see a tiger or an elephant. Sometimes, even though they're not going to harm us at all, sometimes the power of these beings is what scares us. They're more powerful than you are. And of course, these nimittas are way, way more powerful than you are. So at first, when they come up, yes, no, they are. You can hear the senses. So you hear the sounds. You can feel your body. But as the nimitta develops, those feelings of the body and the experience of sounds go further and further away until they disappear totally. The nimitta is just too strong and blissful. Even people who are just enjoying themselves in the worldly life can sometimes just cut out all sound. I like to tell anecdotes. There's a story of a Malaysian Chinese couple, disciples of mine, who told me this story, that they were at home, sitting on their sofa, watching a movie. When the movie finished, one got up to put a kettle on to make themselves a cup of tea, while the other one went to the toilet. But as soon as they got up from the sofa, they realized many things in their house were missing. In particular, the shelves just behind their sofa was missing of many valuable items. The burglar had been in the house while they were sitting on the sofa watching a movie and had the nerve to actually go right behind the sofa and take things right behind them. And they didn't hear or notice a thing. They were so absorbed into the movie. And I told them, if you could only be so absorbed into your breath when you're meditating, so you didn't hear anybody coughing or making a noise, then you'd be great meditators. How come you can do that when you're watching a movie, but you can't do that when you're meditating? He always complained. He made a noise. She made a noise. Somebody talked. Somebody sort of went bang. You can do that when you're watching a movie. Why? Because they were absorbed in the delight of that movie. When you get absorbed in the incredible delights, much better than a movie of a nimitta, then eventually you just can't hear a thing. You can't feel your body, that your bladder needs to be relieved or your legs need to be moved. You can't feel anything at all. You get into some really great meditations now. And just even getting to a nimitta stage, especially the big nimittas, if that's as far as you go, you come out afterwards, you'll have a huge smile on your face. You'll be so happy. Five hindrances will be so far away. But someone comes up and says, you stupid idiot. You just proud nincompoop, whatever you call yourselves, that you won't get upset at all. I remember seeing Ajahn Chah being abused and scolded. And what did he do? He just laughed his head off. He thought it was so funny being called an idiot. That shows you that you are way beyond praise and blame and otherworldly stuff. You just had a beautiful nimitta experience. Wow, this is brilliant, this is good. So that's getting into the power of the mind. The nimitta is a vehicle which takes you from the end of the breathing to the doorway into the jhanas. I mentioned this simile already, just like in the Weluwana. The King Ajatasattu went in a chariot as far as a chariot could take him, got up from the chariot and walked in his slippers through the bamboo grove to the door of the hall. There he had to walk without any slippers into the hall to be where the Buddha was sitting. That's like this meditation practice. The breath can only take you so far. It takes you to the nimittas. The nimitta only takes you so far to the doorway of the jhanas. And it is a fair simile to say, in the jhanas you see where the Buddha was sitting or standing. The elephant's footprint simile. Which was, interestingly, the first teaching which the Arahat Mahinda gave to Devanampiyatissa, the king, when he first came to this island. Was it 2,200, 300 years ago? The first teaching was the elephant's footprint simile, where the Arahat Mahinda said, if you find the elephant's footprint, you find that, you know, that's basically all other footprints can fill into that. That's a sign, the elephant, the sign of the Buddha. It's not the four footprints of an elephant, but the four jhanas. That's where the Buddha sat and lived. And I know this is a freaky thing to say, but if ever you want to go to the four holy places of Buddhism, to visit where the Buddha lived and practiced, the four holy places of Buddhism are not Lumbini, Bodh Gaya, the deer park of Sarnath, and Kusinara. Those are the places the Buddha's body lived. If you want to find where the Buddha's mind lived, that is the first, second, third, and fourth jhanas. And now you're at the doorway in those nimittas. And the next stage is going to take you to where the Buddha lived, where his mind existed, in the four jhanas. And those jhana stages, if you have a first jhana, when you come out afterwards, you realize that your mind was precisely the same as a Buddha's mind in the first jhana. All human beings, once we get to those experiences, they're exactly the same. My jhana, your jhana, same experience. Now, you are really tasting how the Buddha lived with your own direct experience. And if you want to get inspired, that will inspire you for years. One experience of a jhana when you realize what that means. And the nimittas are the doorway. You know, you get a nimitta. Wow, it's a nimitta. Alas, now I've got a nimitta. I've got a nimitta. No. Any type of excitement like that, will destroy the nimitta straight away. So don't be excited. It's not a personal achievement. It just happens to everybody. It's not special. You're not special. So don't get excited. It just spoils it. Thank you for reminding that. This afternoon's talk, 3 o'clock, I was asked not to do a Q&A session. And that fits for today. because the next talk that's for you is on the jhanas. What happens after nimittas? See you then. If you get a jhana beforehand, you don't need to come. Very good.